Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
To RNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At Texas Tech University, God and science are clashing in the classroom. The Justice Department is investigating a complaint brought against a biology professor by a former student. The student believes in creationism, but the professor refuses to give recommendations to students who deny human evolution. Tonight on Point, God and Science in Texas and the national confrontation between creationism and evolution. We begin with the latest on the new bin Laden tape and a recorded statement broadcast today on the Arab network Al Jazeera. Osama bin Laden calls for all Muslims to show solidarity and defend the Iraqi people. But is the tape evidence, as Washington claims, of an Al-Qaeda-Iraq partnership? Bob Drogon is national security correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. I asked him to describe the main message of the bin Laden tape.
There are a couple of messages. Essentially, he's saying he's still there. He's reminding his followers that he's aligning himself with the Iraqi people. He's reminding his followers that he needs new recruits, and he's reaching out to them.
What does the intent of the message seem to be?
Well, the Bush administration version of the intent is that he's aligning himself formally with Saddam Hussein. There seems to be some dispute about that.
The message itself says that he does not align himself with Saddam Hussein, as I read it. He says the fighting, this is against the United States, against infidels, I guess, should be in the name of God only, not in the name of national ideologies, nor to seek victory for the ignorant governments that rule all Arab states, including Iraq. That would sound like distancing himself from Saddam Hussein.
Well, that I would agree with that, and so do others. But the White House and the State Department, among others, are taking the position, and the CIA, taking the position that he's essentially embrace the regime, and that this is further proof of the links that Secretary Powell made very public last week at the United Nations.
Does that look like a credible position, giving the actual words in the statement, Bob Drogon?
Well, let's just say it's in dispute. I've spoken to a number of people who follow terrorism and look at it from the other point of view, which is that, one, what this shows is U.S. policy may well have created a tactical alliance among former enemies that did not exist in the past, or that simply that we've given another opportunity for Osama bin Laden to reach into a well of discontent and to look for followers among those who are opposed to this war.
What's the word today on the authenticity of the tape? Is there any doubt that this is Osama bin Laden?
It hasn't been 100% confirmed. The NSA will do tests on it, the National Security Agency, and that'll take a day or so. But pretty much everyone says it certainly sounds like him. They're working on the assumption that it is him. It sounds authentic. It's a stronger tape in many ways than the one we last heard, which was back in November.
Stronger? How so?
Stronger just in terms of his voice quality. The last one sounded like it may have come down a telephone line. This one seems more direct.
We've seen a couple of different translations. I'm looking at one here from Reuters. It says, "We are following with great interest the preparations of the Crusaders to launch war on the former capital of Muslims," I guess he means Baghdad, "and to install a puppet government." This sounds like a bin Laden intent on making hay out of war with Iraq.
I think that's very clear. Those who follow bin Laden will tell you that he has aligned himself several times in the past with causes that were not part of his initial agenda. For example, in late 2001, he suddenly aligned himself with the Palestinian cause, where he'd really shown no particular interest in that before. This was during the Intifada. And Arafat, in fact, was very quick to try and deny that, and I anticipate that, in fact, Saddam Hussein will try and deny any connections here as well.
Colin Powell was talking about this tape before it was even aired by Al Jazeera today. How did the U.S. know about the tape in advance of its being broadcast?
Well, actually, it's fascinating. He not only spoke about it, he said he had a transcript of it, and George Tenet, the head of the CIA, was up on the Hill an hour later and was asked about it and said he hadn't seen a transcript. So I asked the CIA how it is that Colin Powell had a transcript and the CIA does it, and I never got a straight answer. So I don't know is the question, but it's obviously, they obtained it.
The tape calls for more suicide attacks, saying they're important in fighting for the Muslim cause. Is it possible that this tape is related to the heightened security alert that was issued late last week, the orange alert?
There's real concern about that. In the past, when bin Laden has issued a tape, in a number of cases, terrorist attacks have followed. They have never cracked a code, so to speak. They've never seen something on the tape, him tugging his ear, you know, or saying some code word that they were able to subsequently to link and say that was the message that said, you know, go and throw the bomb or whatever. But there is concern that just his appearance may well be some kind of go signal. So my understanding is they look at this tape and they just, it sort of raises the alarm even further in there, or their concern even further.
Bob, as this tape is going over with a fine-tooth comb, what view do you think is likely to come out of it? That it's more persuasive as evidence of a real link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, or it's persuasive as evidence of the potentially galvanizing power behind Al-Qaeda of a U.S. attack on Iraq?
I think it's going to be both. The administration clearly views this and has been trumpeting the tape all day. Colin Powell was the first to announce it, that it's evidence or even, in fact, proof that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are now official bedfellows, so to speak. I think others will look at it and look at the transcript and say that it says no such thing. It's simply Osama bin Laden proving himself to be a very shrewd analyst of popular opinion around the world and an opportunist trying to cash in on anti-U.S. sentiment.
Does this look like a man, sound like a man to your ear, Bob Drogon, who's still capable of winning hearts and minds in the Islamic world?
Well, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, spoke this morning giving a threat assessment, his annual review, and he certainly described Al-Qaeda as a continuing threat, one that's been fragmented to a certain degree. But two-thirds of the Al-Qaeda leadership remains at large. Osama bin Laden remains at large. We're in a state of heightened alert as of last Friday for only the second time since September 11. So whether it's Osama bin Laden who's calling the shots or one of his lieutenants, obviously they are tremendously capable, and the officials who monitor them are exceedingly nervous.
And finally, Bob Drogon, Osama bin Laden delivers another tape. Any speculation among officials in Washington today about where he is?
Tremendous speculation, Tom, and basically your guess is as good as theirs. The tape is an audio tape. He doesn't appear on it. There are reasons for that. One is in the past when he's appeared on videotapes, then they've been able to analyze pictures of the rocks and whatnot to get some sense as to where he might be. And secondly, presumably bin Laden doesn't want to show his picture to show whether he looks different or if he's in bad health or if he's shaved or if he's in a hospital bed or anything. So there's no clues that we know of that come from the tape itself. It was delivered overnight to Al Jazeera at their base in Qatar, and that's as far as we know, at least publicly.
Bin Laden at large, but still capable of delivering a message that really gets people's attention. Bob Drogon, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogon is national security correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us earlier today from Silver Spring, Maryland. And on the sixth day, God created man, or did he? What about evolution? At Texas Tech University, Dr. Michael Dinney addressed a rising tide of young American creationists by insisting that his students affirm a scientific explanation for the origin of the human species in order to receive his recommendation to graduate or medical schools. Meanwhile, throughout the country, states are facing pressure from fundamentalist Christian groups to rewrite standards for science education. They want alternate views of evolution introduced into classrooms and textbooks. Many think God created the world and scientists created evolution. In Texas and elsewhere, American science is running up against Americans not prepared to believe in science, at least as Darwin drew it. So who is being persecuted here? The student who believes in creationism or the professor who believes in evolution? Does religious belief have a place in the science classroom? Can a teacher demand that a science student embrace science? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Dr. Ted Reed, professor of ophthalmology, visual science, cell biology, and biochemistry at Texas Tech Medical School. Good evening and welcome, Ted Reed.
Well, good evening to you, too.
Thank you so much for being with us. Also with us tonight is Kelly Shackelford, chief counsel of the Liberty Legal Institute, a nonprofit group which represents individuals on First Amendment rights, family and religious freedoms, a Christian group also based in Texas. Good evening and welcome, Kelly Shackelford.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Ted Reed, if I could turn to you first, what can you tell us about the case of Michael Dinney? We read that he put on his website what he
required for his recommendation to graduate school, and that a young student attended a couple of classes, then saw what was on the website, felt it clashed with his personal beliefs, left the class, and that case is now being brought by Kelly Shackelford's group, or has been brought to the attention of the Justice Department, which is investigating. A suit could follow. What is it that Michael Dinney is standing up for here?
Well, basically what he's standing up for is, what is science? That's what it really comes down to. And also he's standing up for the rights of a professor to set standards when they write a personal letter of recommendation. So there's sort of two different issues going on at once here. And in the one case, when I say he's standing up for science, he's not. That's not part of the class now. I want to make sure that that's well known, because I know, for instance, in the New York Times, they said that Dinney is insisting that his students accept evolution. Well, that's not what he says. He is, I want to be very clear about this. For instance, this is not in the class, this is for the letter of recommendation.
Yes.
Dr. Dinney states, first of all, he's going to ask the student, how do you think the human species originated?
Mm-hmm.
And then he asks, if you cannot truthfully and forthrightly affirm a scientific answer to this question, then you shouldn't ask for a letter of recommendation.
That word affirm is very interesting
and
rather strong.
That's a key word. The key word affirm, and of course, what does affirm mean? Well, affirm can mean several things. And one, if you look in the dictionary, it means to validate, confirm, or to state positively.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he's saying is that the student is required to say this is what science says. The student doesn't have to believe this.
Mm-hmm.
But the student has to understand what science says. And this is, of course, a key thing, because you will get conflicting things like, say, intelligent design or other things which are not science and have no scientific bearing whatsoever. But those are other views. And what he's asking for is the student to essentially affirm what science says.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key issue here. And it's really an understanding of what is science. And the reason for this, and I think there's a very good example of this recently I read, where Stephen Jay Gould reported back in 1984 that the cardiologist who was asked to transplant, who actually transplanted a baboon heart in Baby Fay in Loma Linda, California,
Yes. He
was asked, why did you use a baboon heart? Clearly a chimpanzee heart is closer to humans in DNA. He replied, I don't believe in evolution. And this is a very good example of why it's important for a person who wants to become a medical doctor to have an understanding of what is evolution.
We'll look at some of what Michael Dinney himself has said on his own website, but I want to get Kelly Shackelford in here. Mr. Shackelford, why you've taken up the student's case. Clearly, in your mind, there is an offense that's been committed here in Michael Dinney saying right up front that he won't give a letter of recommendation unless a student can affirm this theory and science of evolution. Why?
Well, I mean, basically, the issue here is basic academic freedom, the ability to freely believe and not be discriminated against because of your beliefs. I mean, what we just heard would be consistent with saying that any doctor in our country right now, and this is what Dinney says on his website, who dares to not believe personally in evolution should leave the medical profession. I mean, if he had the power, I guess he would, have those people kicked out of their positions.
I don't think he says that exactly, but he comes out very strongly in favor of the scientific importance of evolution.
Well,
he
goes on to refer to evolution as fact, and he says that if you do not affirm that belief, that he doesn't think you should be practicing in the medical profession.
But shouldn't it be within the purview of a biology professor to decide which students he will recommend? And if he finds students who don't embrace evolution, to his mind, may not be, as you point out, him saying, fitting as doctors, how could he recommend them?
Well, he as a university professor, using a university website with these standards, I mean, these are public officials using taxpayer money, he can have any beliefs he wants. He can have any standards he wants regarding his students. He can compel that they understand things. He can't, as the government, tell people what they may and may not believe personally. There's a huge difference there. He can have opinions that groups of people are inferior, but he can't, enforce that through his class.
Are you saying that a science professor cannot ask students that he recommends to validate, to believe in science?
Well,
I don't think there's any question that these students would say they believe in science and they believe in, I mean, you know, that kind of an argument, let's say during the time of Hitler, you know, there would be plenty of evolutionists who would argue that they're, that certain races are, you know, subservient to others.
Kelly Shackelford, hold the thought. We're going to come back after a short break. We're talking tonight about God and science in Texas and the national confrontation of creationism and evolution. Is it wrong for a science professor to deny a recommendation to a student who denies science? We're at 1-800-423-8255. National confrontation of creationism and evolution. Question for you. Who is persecuted in the Texas Tech case? The student who embraces creationism or the professor who defends evolution? Would you recommend a biology student who doesn't affirm evolution? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Lubbock, Texas by Dr. Ted Reed, a professor of ophthalmology, visual science, cell biology, and biochemistry at Texas Tech Medical School, and a colleague of Professor Michael Deeney, who's now being investigated by the Justice Department for his position on which students he will recommend to graduate school, to medical school. We're also joined tonight by from Dallas, Texas, by Kelly Shackelford, Chief Counsel of the Liberty Legal Institute, a Christian lawyers group based there in Texas. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Ted Reed, you heard Kelly Shackelford just before the break saying it's not right for a professor to dictate the beliefs of his student, even in a science class.
Well, I also heard him say, which actually surprised me, that there was nothing wrong with having a student believe in science, which actually I was surprised to hear him say. Which is really the crux of the matter. We're not talking about religion here. We're not talking about what they believe from a religious standpoint. And what we're really, what it really comes down to, possibly, is the when dogma of a religion doesn't conflict with science. Mm. That's where the sort of the metal hits the road. But what Deeney is requiring here, again, to emphasize, is that students have to affirm this is what science says. And this is what good science is based on, is evolution. Evolution is a cornerstone of modern biology, and it's a cornerstone of allowing us to make lots of interpretations and lots of very important decisions considering medicine nowadays.
May I ask you a couple of questions about
Sure.
Professor Deeney? First of all, is he a raging atheist of some kind?
Well, if you went to Dr. Deeney's website, you'd see that he actually studied for the priesthood at one time. So
I've read that he's a devout Catholic.
I don't know actually what he is. I do know that he studied for the priesthood, mm-hmm, and he was a very religious person.
And secondly, I wonder why Professor Deeney felt compelled to even include this in the list of things that he'd look for before giving a recommendation. Is there such a volume of students at the university level in Texas who are rejecting evolution that he needs this as a first screen, saying if you don't accept this, don't come any closer if you want a recommendation?
Well, it's certainly there's many more students here than I've ever experienced. I've taught at Yale University for 14 years, and I taught at the University of California for 7 years. And I've never seen quite the numbers that we are presented with at this university. So I could see why Dr. Deeney would be very dismayed, because it's not these students, in many cases, don't even want to think about what evolution teaches us. And that's the important thing. People think there's a trivial issue that all we're doing is trying to cause trouble for a religion, which is not the case. I mean, science has no stand from a religious standpoint. All we can do is say this is very, very important science. This is science that teaches us important concepts, and it is a cornerstone of biology. It allows us to predict what's going to happen in many cases.
Kelly Shackelford, if I may ask, how did you take this case to the Justice Department? What reception have you got there? Where does the case, the investigation, stand?
Well, what happened was when we originally found out and talked to this student and what happened to him, mm-hmm. We contacted the school because when we looked on the website and saw that despite what Dr. Reed just said, it's not affirming what science says. I mean, we have talked to students since then who have made straight A's in Deeney's class, but were told that they did not, when they were asked mm-hmm. if they believed that man was created by God, if they said yes, they were out of the picture regarding the letter of recommendation. And we tried to get that corrected with the school. We said you can compel understanding as the government. You can't compel and tell people what they have to believe. and they refused to do anything about it. And at that point, we filed a complaint with the Justice Department, and they're fairly hush-hush. They don't talk to us. They don't even talk to, you know, our client. All they do is, if they think that there's merit, they open an investigation, and evidently they have opened an investigation, and that's why a lot of this press has come out. And in fact, it's been very helpful, because we've had students literally coming out of the woodworks with story after story, people who have completely changed their career because of what Deanie has done. I mean, just stuff that really breaks your heart if you care about academic freedom for students and their ability to do what they're supposed to do at a university, which is investigate, look for answers, be wide open, not a place where you're told that you have to believe this or suffer the consequences.
Kelly Shuckenford, there's so much I want to get to here, but let me just ask nuts and bolts first. Do you intend to bring suit against Texas Tech University?
That's our last option, and we're getting closer and closer to that. But certainly we will stand by the rights of students all over the country to have their own personal beliefs and to not be persecuted because some professor doesn't like their personal beliefs.
Michael Deanie has said he won't budge, but he says on his website about his question on human evolution, he says, "Why do I ask this question? That is, how do you account for the scientific origin of the human species?" He says, "Whereas medicine is historically rooted first in the practice of magic and later in religion, modern medicine is an endeavor that springs from the sciences, biology prominent among these. The central unifying principle of biology is the theory of evolution. Someone who ignores the most important theory in biology cannot expect to properly practice in a field that is now so heavily based on biology." Kelly Shuckenford, that sounds reasonable to me. Where do you have a problem with that?
Well, it's perfectly fine to affirm, and we have students who can, who've made A's in this class, who can explain evolution left and right, go through it. But when you say that you have to have my personal belief about how man was created, you stepped over the line. Number one, it's not something that's observable, that's subject to the scientific method.
Well, if I may just interrupt for a moment, Michael Deanie would appear to disagree. He says on the website again, "Good medicine, like good biology, is based on the collection and evaluation of physical evidence. So much physical evidence supports the evolution of humans from non-human ancestors that one can validly refer to the fact of human evolution, even
exactly.
if all the details are not yet known."
And that's why this is not science. This is a religious litmus test. I mean, this is
Wait, but are you saying that the evidence that he says is there does not exist?
No, I'm saying that he is requiring a theory that is in science, a theory, be accepted as a fact.
He's saying there's enough evidence that it may now be validly referred to as a fact.
Well, I mean, he's exercising his faith, which is obviously not the same as other people, and he's trying to tell people what they have to believe about science, not teaching them science, not explaining evolution, not having them understand and be able to describe it, but forcing them as a government official to believe as he does or suffer the consequences.
Ted Reed, could you respond to that interpretation that Kelly Shuckenford is drawing an equivalency here between faith and science? He's effectively saying science is faith. It's just another religion. Do you hear that at Texas Tech frequently?
Well, I mean, I've heard people make that statement, but this is certainly far from the truth. A religion requires many different things, something different than what science requires. Science requires, first of all, that, for instance, the study of evolution, that it's testable, that it's falsifiable, and that it's predictable. And these are all qualities that do not cover a religion. There's nothing to do with faith there. These are why, in fact, I will tell you that I believe that evolution is both a theory and a fact. In fact, we probably should just call it a law, because by now we have so much evidence that there's no one that really believes that this is going to be disproven. So what Mr. Sasser is saying is just not true.
Mr. Shuckenford.
Or Shuckenford, pardon me. This is not true, because this is a science, and that's, of course, the crux of this matter. What is science? And that's the problem here, that people don't understand, or at least these particular people do not understand what science is. And also it's not true that they have to say that they believe in evolution. They only have to believe that this is what science says.
That's
now, whether
false.
They want to agree with that from a religious standpoint is a totally different matter. For instance, they can believe, science cannot prove, for instance, that God didn't create the world in 1860.
Mm-hmm.
That is not possible. If God, in her wisdom, put down all these pieces of evidence to say that the world was created before that, we can't disprove that. Science is only stuck with the evidence. We look at the evidence, and we have to come to a conclusion. We use that. We test it. And that's what science is stuck with.
Ted Reed, Kelly Shackelford, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome into our conversation tonight from Oakland, California, Eugenie Scott. She's executive director of the National Center for Science Education. This is a nonprofit group which defends the teaching of evolution in public schools. Good evening and welcome, Eugenie Scott.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Eugenie. When you heard about this Texas Tech case, what was your response? Can you put this into context for us? How widespread today is this clash between science and religion in the science classroom?
Well, if you can pardon an obvious pun, the first thing that came to mind was, look who's gunning for Denny. This professor really didn't do anything terribly unusual. Students are turned down for letters of recommendation for any number of reasons by any number of professors. And actually, when I looked at Professor Denny's website, I was quite impressed by how meticulous he was about spelling out all of the criteria. This is only criterion number three. It's sort of way down the list.
But did it surprise you to see this flashpoint at Texas Tech, or is this part of a fabric of confrontation that you're seeing across the country?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but then this is my day job to watch these kinds of things. No, the teaching of evolution is under fire primarily at the high school and junior high level, less so at the college level.
But how significant, how widespread is the challenge to the teaching of evolution?
Well, I've often said, not totally jokingly, but if you want to put me down in any city within 24 hours, I'll either find you a teacher who is afraid to teach evolution or one who is teaching creationism.
That's one teacher in any city doesn't necessarily sound like that much. Is that what you're saying?
Well, in 24 hours, maybe I couldn't find them all. No, in all seriousness, I go to conferences of teachers, and I present at colleges and universities, and I do workshops for teachers. And I'm always getting buttonholed by teachers saying, oh, you know, I've got this chairman who doesn't want us to teach evolution, or, oh, our superintendent told us to just cool it this year because there's an election coming up and school board members, you know, he doesn't want to get them riled up.
And is that pressure having an effect? Is evolution sliding back, or is creationism or the biblical story coming more to the fore in American schools?
Well, the problem, of course, is that there are no good data on this. And as a scientist, I really don't like to make blanket statements without data. It certainly is my impression, as somebody who is very carefully studying this controversy, that the amount of evolution, that evolution is definitely under attack in the country. And it seems to me that, like I say, I don't have any data, but I would not be surprised if there was less evolution being taught.
Is it your impression that the United States is becoming a less scientifically oriented nation?
Well, we do have data on that. And certainly the comparisons of scores of United States high school and junior high students with those of their contemporaries in other countries show that we do have quite a science literacy gap. Similarly, studies of adult Americans and their knowledge of science and their knowledge of science as a way of knowing of the how science works is also very much inferior to that of their contemporaries in other countries, other developed countries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Eugenie Scott, Kelly Shackelford, Ted Reed, if you'll stand by, please. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Scott's calling. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Well, to start with, first of all, I'm a physician, so I'm something of a scientist myself.
All right.
To address this issue, first of all, I think it's appalling that this discussion has to come up. You know, we're not teaching that the Earth is flat anymore either, for good reason. It's and evolution is as much of a fact as the shape of the Earth at this point.
But you understand why we're talking about it, Scott, because there's a professor and a university and potentially a national precedent that's on the line here.
Absolutely. And, you know, as unfortunate as it is that this has to come up as a debating point, I think it's a good thing that he has taken this stand and that he's, you know, placed his position out there so eloquently. Suppose this student, for instance, who is pre-med, from my understanding,
yes, he is,
decides at some point, based on his faith rather than on science, that AIDS isn't really caused by HIV. We've already seen the president of a large nation make that blunder for a couple of years.
South Africa.
So, why do we have to, you know, why do we have to say that a professor needs to endorse? And let's keep in mind that a letter of recommendation is an endorsement.
Yes, it is.
Based on a professor's understanding of the student. Why do we have to have a professor who is a scientist endorse a student who does not, at base, understand the nature of scientific inquiry?
Scott, hang with us. Kelly Shackelford, how would you respond to that question, please?
Well, I mean, in a number of ways. I mean, does that mean it's okay for a political science teacher who's a Democrat to say, well, Republicans got it all wrong, and I'm not going to give it a letter of recommendation to any Republican, even though I'm a state official? I mean, we would never stand for that type of mind control position. You can, again, this is people who make straight A's in his class are disqualified because of their personal beliefs, not because their ability to grapple with and understand evolution, their ability to describe it, their ability to apply it in different science experiments. We're talking about not microevolution, but macroevolution. Where did the Earth come from? Where did man come from? Something that nobody was there to observe, something that is not a scientific fact because it's not subject to the scientific method. Microevolution is not really an issue, and I don't think very many people debate about that. But to tell people what they have to believe about the origin of the universe and the Earth and human beings is not science. It's stepping over the line, and it's telling people what they can and cannot believe.
And Eugenie Scott, I heard you there as well.
Yes, thanks, Tom. As a former college professor who's written a lot of letters of recommendation, I really would like to clear up one misconception that the caller might be leaving, and that is that the letter of recommendation is an affirmation of the student. It isn't. The letter of recommendation is an honest description to the recipient of the letter of what the writer feels are the abilities of the student. Your responsibility as someone who writes a letter of recommendation is not to puff the student. Your responsibility is to give the graduate school or the job or whoever is receiving the letter an honest evaluation of that student's abilities.
We've got it. I want to go back to my caller, Scott. Scott, are you satisfied with this response, I guess from Kelly Shackelford in particular?
Well, no. I mean, Mr. Shackelford's really comparing apples and oranges when he talks about the difference between political science and evolution. I mean, that's really a cultural milieu that you're getting into when you mm-hmm. discuss political science. But to address the issue of a letter of recommendation, I agree that a letter of recommendation should be objective and based on the facts. But my understanding really throughout my career has been that a letter of recommendation also carries the weight of
well, there's an endorsement of what the student has learned, certainly, and I
right.
guess nobody would argue with that. Scott, thanks for
the quality of the student's reasoning as well.
Yep, we've got it. Scott, thanks for your call. Ted Reed, we just got 20 seconds before the break here, but do you feel a chilling effect as a result of this attention to Michael Deeney's approach?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's the types of statements that are made by people like Mr. Shackelford just now, mm-hmm. who said that, in fact, made a bare statement that there is no evidence for macroevolution. I mean, these kinds of statements are very chilling to people that have to teach this because, in fact, there's a lot of evidence. And scientifically, this is well known. So the trouble we're up against is people putting out this misinformation mm-hmm. about evolution and what evolution tells us.
We've got to take a short break. Ted Reed, please stand by. We're talking about God and science in Texas. You can join the conversation. Who is persecuted in the Texas Tech case? The student who embraces creationism or the professor who defends evolution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from
confrontation between evolution and creationism in the science classroom.
The Bible is a book. It's a good book. But it is not the only book. It is the revealed word of the Almighty God. Spake to the man who wrote the Bible.
How do you know that God didn't speak to Charles Darwin?
I know because God tells me to oppose the evil teachings of that man.
Oh, God speaks to you?
Yes.
He tells you what is right and wrong?
Yes.
And you act accordingly?
Yes.
So you, Matthew, Harrison, Brady, through oratory or legislature or whatever, you pass on God's orders to the rest of the world. Well...
Spencer Tracy and Frederick March in the classic film Inherit the Wind, based on the 1925 trial of Tennessee teacher John Scopes. You can join our conversation tonight. Can we educate real scientists in America if professors are required to give equal standing to creationism? Is defending evolution discriminatory, or is it defending science? Who's winning this debate, science or religion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jason's calling from New London, Wisconsin. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind, Jason?
Well, I want them to prove the theory of evolution. I want to see cold, hard data.
You want it right here, right now. You're a doubter.
Yeah, I'm a doubter. I fully believe in creation because there is proof out there, and it's the Bible. It clearly states in Genesis that the earth was created in 6 days by God himself.
And do you literally accept that as fact, Jason?
That is fact. It is cold, hard fact.
Eugenie Scott, I'm sure it's not the first time that you've heard this, and how do you respond? This is Jason's firm belief.
Well, you used absolutely the correct noun. This is Jason's belief. And quite frankly, I've spoken with lots of Jasons in this country, and shaking a belief is a very difficult thing. Jason says he wants proof, but I doubt that I could ever provide proof that to him would be any way convincing. But I would encourage you, Jason, to check an organization called the American Scientific Affiliation, which is a group of evangelical Christians, most of whom accept evolution. Go to www.asa3.org and get on the chat rooms and see what some other serious Christians have to say about this topic.
So there's something less than a proof, but it's a counter challenge. Jason, thanks for your call. Ted Reed, I want to ask something of you. Kelly Shackelford earlier quoted a student, or roughly quoted, from Michael Deeney's class, or at least from the university, as I understood it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kelly Shackelford, saying when they heard, their understanding was that if they thought man was created by God, they were out of there. Now, is there a contradiction in your mind between the evolution Michael Deeney wants to see taught and the notion of humankind created by an almighty creator?
Well, first of all, my first impression when I heard that statement was, having talked with Dr. Deeney in the past, is that that's just flat out not true. Dr. Deeney, just because someone would say, look, I believe that God created humans in 7 days, he's not going to throw them out. However, if they cannot say, this is what science tells us, and this is the scientific basis of evolution, then he will not give them a letter of recommendation. He will not. We're talking again. This is a science question. This is not a religious question.
But I guess I want to ask you just at a little bit broader level. Do you see, and perhaps you're not a religious man at all, but do you see a contradiction? Leave out the 6 or 7 days. That's a literal taking from the Bible. We understand that people do take it literally. But is it possible in your mind that the creation by God and evolution may coexist? Are they necessarily contradictory?
They're not contradictory because, first of all, science does not take a position on God. There is limitations to science, and scientists will recognize that. Like I told you a few minutes ago, we cannot predict. Science cannot tell if the world was created, say, 20 years ago, and all the evidence was put here to tell us that it was an older Earth. We just have to go by the facts. Science is stuck with the facts. And that's why when the class caller asks for facts for evolution, there's an incredible number of facts for evolution. In fact, I give a class in which I teach the study, I ask the question, which is there more facts for, that there was a civil war or that evolution occurred? And what comes out of that is that when you really look at what are the facts for a civil war, and you look at what are the facts for evolution, you see it's overwhelming. The facts for evolution, because...
Then why are we having this conversation in 2003, silly. Ted Reed?
Because some religious views are completely incompatible with evolution, like young Jason who just called.
Yes.
But Jason represents only one slice of, say, Christianity, which is the dominant religion in the United States. The Catholics and mainline Protestants don't have a problem with evolution. I mean, in my experience, there's more evolution taught in Catholic and Lutheran schools than there is in public schools.
Kelly Shackelford, would you agree with that broad analysis?
No, I mean, I think when they do the polls that I've seen, most of the country, the majority of the country, doesn't believe in evolution as far as creation or believes in something more consistent.
Is that a good thing in your mind, Kelly Shackelford?
I don't really care. I don't have a dog in the evolution creation fight. I've committed my career and what I do to defending people's ability to freely think without the government telling them what they can and cannot think. And that's the danger that's going on here, because especially within the academic community, the professors, evolution is considered sort of a religious mantra, and so anybody who dares to disagree is treated like these students are being treated. I don't think that they would ever do this if it was a different belief. But because this
and yet there's science and there's scientific method. Joseph's calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm an academic. I'm a professor of philosophy.
Yes.
And I've had to write recommendations from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
This debate is about American ideals of equality in a certain way. And the trouble is that academia is a meritocracy. And America has always been uneasy with that. No one is telling the students what to believe. It's the professor's prerogative to decide who understands the subject matter and how well. He's the professional. And this person is being fair enough to say, this is how I know how well you understand things. You know, the professor has a responsibility to be forthright with the students. I've had to write recommendations for students where I said, it can't be that good, but, you know, some of them decided to go ahead. But, you know, I just tell them, you know, how good it's going to be and how good it's not going to be.
So you're saying this professor is discriminating on the basis of his professional assessment of the students, of a student's view.
Bingo.
But I beg your pardon, I didn't get that.
You're saying that the professor is discriminating here on the basis of his professional assessment of a student's view or understanding of a body of knowledge. But Kelly Shackelford is saying the knowledge itself is a kind of religion, and so the professor's not in a position to judge.
But he's wrong. That's not the case. I wasn't going to get into that aspect of it, but evolution names events in the world, and then we have to account for how those events occurred with a theory, just like gravitation points to the fact that we keep sticking to the surface of the Earth.
Yes, I guess it does. Joseph, our time is running short, but thanks for the call. Eugenie Scott, where are we headed if religion keeps confronting science in this way and makes headway against it? Can we be a 21st century, a successful, thriving 21st century country if Michael Deanies of the world have to say, well, all right, creationism, evolution, equivalent?
Well, the problem is we're going to end up with a two-tier society, with those people who go to college and are taught subjects like evolution matter-of-factly, which I'm sure that Ted Reed will agree goes on at Texas Tech, and it's just not controversial at the university level, and those people who don't go to college and who really don't understand what modern science is all about.
Well, I beg to differ. It is controversial at the university level. That's what we're talking about tonight.
If you go to a university library, how many journals do you find where you find the idea of descent with modification, of common ancestry being debated?
Well, I would only point out, we're in our closing minutes here, but we're looking at a professor who felt it significant enough that he had to make it a primary requirement for his personal recommendation.
That's not the same
thing. That may soon bring a suit against his university, and with that, I apologize, Eugenie Scott. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us tonight. Eugenie Scott is Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Kelly Shackelford in Dallas, Texas, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Kelly Shackelford is Chief Counsel of the Liberty Legal Institute, a Christian Lawyers Group, and Ted Reed at Texas Tech University Medical School in Lubbock, Texas. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. The debate over evolution is not only playing out in American schools, it is also raging on American bumpers. It all started in the 1980s when Christian drivers started sticking the ichthys, or truth fish, representing Jesus on the back of their cars. Secularists responded with a parody ornament, a fish with legs with the name Darwin written across it. Soon there was an all-out bumper brawl. Truth fish were drawn devouring Darwin fish. Darwin fish were depicted upside down, their little legs in the air to indicate that they were dead. Tom Lessel is a professor who specializes in symbolic communication at the University of Georgia. He was curious about the piscatorial free-for-all and what exactly the drivers with the Darwin fish were trying to say, so he started putting questionnaires on their cars. To his surprise, he found that people take their Darwin fish very seriously.
There are people that wrote extensive responses that went on for as many as 3 pages of typed commentary explaining what the symbol meant to them. And in those cases, you're talking about people who have a very sophisticated sense of the world and a very definite kind of worldview that's closely tied up with their attraction to science and their belief that science offers a distinctive kind of understanding of the natural world. There were people that said in the response that they'd never displayed anything on their car before in their lives, and that this symbol was the only thing that they currently had displayed on their car. So they wanted me to know that they weren't the kind of people that just frivolously put bumper stickers on their cars, and that this was a very serious matter for them, that this symbol somehow captured something about what they stood for that was very important to them. So for these people, it was very serious. People were much more likely to see the symbol as an anti-religious symbol than to see it as a pro-science symbol. There was much more said about religion in the responses than was said about science. There were a handful of people that clearly just delighted in the symbol as ridicule. And their responses tended to be very short and to the point. They would give me a few lines in their response and saying, I did this to show the fundamentalists that there are other people around besides them. Early on, when I started distributing these questionnaires, I accidentally put one on an automobile that didn't have a Darwin fish. It had the truth fish eating the Darwin fish. It was a secretary at the university whose car I had put the questionnaire on, and she wrote 3 pages about her objections to the Darwin fish as a Christian. And I thought, wow, this person really has strong feelings about that. So I began to distribute surveys to cars that had the ICSA symbol displayed and asking those folks to tell me what they thought of the Darwin fish. And I quickly discovered that, for the most part, they didn't pay any attention to it. Many of them weren't even aware of it at the time, and many of them really had given little thought to it. So they weren't, the Christian community didn't seem to really pay much heed to the Darwin fish. Well, I think it's tradition in America. It's impolite to talk about politics in polite company. Your mother tells you not to talk about politics or religion in polite company. Those are taboo topics. And so we transfer that need to our automobiles. Whereas in Europe, people talk openly about politics and religion, and they don't display bumper stickers. So my hypothesis is that people have a fundamental need to talk about these things. People have a desire to express these attitudes, but it's difficult, I think, in our culture to discuss them. And so the public forum of an automobile bumper becomes an outlet for that need.
Tom Lessel is a professor of speech communication at the University of Georgia. He specializes in the way humans use symbols to communicate. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting